You are listening to Climate Now. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm James Lawler.
So hydrogen fuel. I don't know about you, James, but when I think about hydrogen as a fuel, I'm kind of stumped by how in the world it's possible to power vehicles or generate electricity with just this one gas element and only get water as a byproduct. It kind of feels like alchemy, like turning things into gold. It's a little bit impossible.
Yeah. And the picture in my head is sort of fourth grade physics filling balloons. So that's where I'm at the beginning of this conversation.
But despite our knowledge of fourth grade chemistry, though enthusiasm for the subject, a lot of advancements in technology have been made in this subject, and investors around the world are putting in a lot of effort to change that. And with us today to give us the ins and outs of this technology is Dr. Benjamin Wiley from Duke University. And you may, during our interview, hear the occasional rooster crowing in the background. Dr. Wiley is joining us from his home, where he owns a coop. So Ben, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
The first question that we ask all of our guests is, how did you get where you are? What's your story?
Growing up, I was definitely interested in new technologies, although not necessarily like science and engineering in junior high and high school. I was kind of better at history and memorizing stuff. And so actually I had planned to go to Georgetown or Columbia and join like a diplomatic corps because I was imagining this glamorous life of being at parties overseas or something like that, you know, something ridiculous, which is totally has no basis in reality except on movies, I guess. You know, I didn't get into Georgetown or Columbia, so I ended up going to the University of Minnesota, my backup school, you know, looking around and realizing I didn't understand what the world was made of is like part of it. I ended up choosing chemical engineering, which was a great major at the University of Minnesota. I didn't really enjoy science and engineering in the classroom, but once I was able to actually try and do a bit of it on my own, that really lit the fire for me, because doing something that no one had ever done before just seemed really cool. I went to graduate school in Seattle and in kind of the heyday of nanotechnology. And so I ended up joining a group where Yunnan Xia, where he was making all these crazy shapes on the nanoscale. And I thought that was so magical.
So when we're talking about nanomaterials, are we talking about structures larger or smaller than proteins and sort of the complicated level of the folding of proteins? I'm just trying to like put this into the my theory of mind for basic science.
Yeah, so proteins are kind of 1 or 2 nanometers or so. So you can make nanostructures that small. So anything in kind of the 1 to 100 nanometer range would be a nanostructure. And the nanowires I worked on had diameters about 10,000 times smaller than the human hair. So just to give you an idea of the length scale. One of the research projects I worked on as an undergraduate was looking at these spheres assembling in this evaporating liquid and making a photonic crystal. And I was like watching that in a camera image. And I was like, I would tell my friends, wow, no one's seen this before. I thought that was so cool to watch that. And it revealed like, yeah, there's this hidden world, you know, at that really small length scales. And then, yeah, you can see that more using electron microscopes. You can even, so my job as an undergrad was like basically cook some nanostructures up and then in the evening, go to the scanning electron microscope and see what shape I made.
I love that, though, but it must have been discovering a new planet every day at 6:30, right? Like, what did we get this time?
You're making me want to ditch everything and go back to school.
That's great. Yeah, I make these new shapes like right by pyramids and nano bars and nano rice. And so it was a lot of fun. Yeah.
So to get us started, can you talk to us about the basic chemistry of producing this pure hydrogen and the process of using that to generate electricity? So what are the chemical reactions that we're talking about?
So this is great because I'm currently teaching these in my general chemistry class. So it's all very fresh in my mind. When you apply a voltage to water, say you apply just 1.5 volts off of a battery, or maybe you want to apply a little bit higher, like 2 volts. So that driving force is enough for you to transfer electrons to the hydrogen atoms in water. So hydrogen as part of water each hydrogen atom actually has a what's called a plus one oxidation state, meaning it's just a proton without its electron, whereas the oxygens are in a minus two oxidation state, meaning they have two extra electrons per atom. And so what you're doing when you're splitting water is you're putting electricity in, the electrons are going to the hydrogen atoms, and then the hydrogen atoms, as they gain electrons, are combining to make hydrogen bubbles on the what's called the cathode, is where you're putting electrons in, and then they kind of just float off. And then at the same time, simultaneously, you're taking electrons out of the oxygen atoms in the water at what's referred to as the anode, oxidation at the anode. The volatiles go together there. So you're taking electrons out of the oxygen and bringing them back to a zero oxidation state from negative two to zero, and they're recombining to make oxygen. So you have to take, you know, four electrons out of the oxygen atoms in water and then recombine them into oxygen to make this reaction happen. And it's that step, which people refer to as oxygen evolution, that tends to be the least efficient step in the process. So that's how you split water. And then when you can use this same, you can just use the reverse reaction to get energy out.
Awesome. So in terms of renewable energy, the question I'd like to start off with is, in this energy oversupply / storage problem, can you describe what it is exactly? And then how does that relate to hydrogen production via electrolysis?
Yeah, sure. As you increase the proportion of renewables on the grid, right? I mean, any renewable, it just generates power whenever. You can't like throw in more coal or take out less coal, or, you know, it's just going to, the wind's going to blow, sun's going to shine. And so you're just generally going to have some mismatch between that power that's generated and how much power that you can use. And for example, in California, I was just looking up this past month, about 4% of the electricity was curtailed or wasted from the solar power. And they have about 25% renewables on their grid right now. So you can imagine if we're trying to get a world where it's 100% or at least 80% of renewables, maybe the rest would be something like hydro and nuclear that's a little more stable. But even at 50%, it's going to be more. It's going to be like 10% of the generation. And it's kind of an open question whether that's a real problem. I mean, maybe that's just the cheapest thing to do, is to make a bunch of solar panels and just dump the electricity.
So renewables aren't always running. And sometimes when they are running, we don't use all the electricity they produce. So we need some way to store the extra energy to use when they're not running.
Hydrogen generation is one of those. I mean, probably more prevalent, people are more familiar with lithium ion batteries, right? As kind of a temporary storage solution and shifting some of that load over. But that's really, it's quite expensive. Those batteries are quite expensive, especially if you wanted to store a lot of electricity.
And how is most hydrogen produced at scale today, and to what end?
So like 2/3 of it is made via heating natural gas with steam. So that then just converts the carbons to CO2, and you strip off all the hydrogens off the natural gas. And then another, you know, around 1/4 is made from coal, mostly in China, kind of same process, heat up coal with steam. And then about 2% is made via electrolysis, actually splitting water with a current. About half of that, or 0.7% of all hydrogen, is what people now refer to as green hydrogen, where you're taking renewable energy and using it to split water to make hydrogen and oxygen.
And why do we produce hydrogen today? What's the end market for hydrogen?
Yeah, so the biggest end market is making ammonia for fertilizer. And then second to that is petroleum refining. So hopefully that goes away. And then another big area is in methanol and chemicals.
And so we're basically producing it through these various ways. And are we compressing it? Are we liquefying it and then shipping it? Is that generally how it's produced and then shipped around? Or is it going through pipes? Or how is it?
My understanding is almost all of it is used locally as some big part of some big refinery or chemical complex. Yeah, because shipping it would increase costs, and that is definitely one of the problems with hydrogen, is it's not dense, right? Less dense than helium. They used it to in the Hindenburg. So it's very hard to compress it and ship it.
Are there other reasons why hydrogen is not a more prevalent sort of end use fuel right now?
For green hydrogen, the biggest issue is the cost of electrolysis. It's just in particular, of which mostly is the cost of electricity. So kind of the resurgence of interest in green hydrogen now is people realizing that with the declining cost of renewable energy, there's going to be some tipping point where electrolysis becomes cheaper than hydrogen from fossil fuels.
And when we consider using hydrogen as a means to store excess energy from renewables as an energy carrier, tell us about what the challenges are there.
As far as using hydrogen as an energy carrier, there's definitely, like I said, challenges. So transportation is one, and then the inefficiency of energy conversion is another. So anytime you're like converting water to hydrogen, right, you're taking a liquid and you're splitting it apart. So you can into gases, right? So at least you're applying the energy required to boil the water. There's an inefficiency there. And then when you get it back, say you put the hydrogen in a fuel cell to power a car, then you have another loss in energy as this gas condenses to become water. And so I think the efficiency of renewable generation going to powering a fuel cell car, the efficiency there is about 22%. So you're losing about 80% of electricity. Where for electric vehicles, it's more in the 70s, where in terms of the efficiency, you're retaining most of the energy that you originally generated.
So why is it something that we should be focused on at all if it's so inefficient?
Yeah, so there's a couple of points. So one is the areas of the economy that you can't decarbonize with batteries. For example, long haul shipping and aviation, going to be very difficult to decarbonize with batteries. And then some industrial processes like ammonia production, for example, is responsible for 1% of greenhouse gas emissions, and steel production is responsible for around 7% of greenhouse gas emissions. So those type of large scale chemical processes that generally currently produce CO2, there's a potential to use hydrogen to decarbonize those areas. So in the case of aviation, you know, people are thinking about, you know, potentially running planes with fuel cells. You could run them with ammonia. You can burn ammonia, and it's a liquid carrier of energy for hydrogen. Or you could try and make synthetic kerosene using hydrogen and even hydrogenating the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to make kerosene or aviation fuel. And kind of the same process, right, for shipping. I mean, there is boats that carry ammonia now internationally, so they could potentially burn it. This is definitely not something that is currently economical, right, without some significant incentives from the government.
Great. And I think some of our listeners would be very keen to know what the levelized cost of hydrogen power is versus other renewables. Can you share any insight on that?
You shouldn't compare necessarily the levelized cost of hydrogen with renewables, since that's kind of just your direct energy that's coming from your solar panel or your wind turbine. But you could compare it with batteries, right? Because those are both storage technologies. For long durations of storage, it makes a lot more sense to store the energy in hydrogen, because you can just store it in a big steel tank rather than in a gigantic battery. And then you can run your fuel cell off that stored hydrogen for a very long time, right? Whereas batteries, they'll typically discharge them in a matter of hours. So that's the advantage, yeah, of hydrogen, is that for, you know, what people call like seasonal storage, where there might be prolonged periods of low wind and solar generation.
You know, you mentioned that there are some inefficiencies in the sort of inherent in the, not necessarily in the chemistry, but in the way in which these reactions happen, like the mechanisms of these electrodes, the physical qualities of these electrodes. And you and your colleagues did a study, you know, that found that a particular kind of material was just significantly more efficient at producing hydrogen than conventional electrolysis. Can you describe what the challenges were and then what you found in the study?
There's been a huge amount of work on water electrolysis, but what I was interested in was almost all that work has focused on efficiency, and meaning how can we get the oxygens to combine better, you know, without wasting so much energy. That's because electricity has been the greatest cost component to making hydrogen. But the reason why people are looking at hydrogen again is because that cost component is going away.
So you mean that in terms of green hydrogen, if these electrolyzers, these water splitting machines are being powered by renewable energy, we pretty much don't have to worry about the cost of powering them, those machines, if electricity is super cheap, as long as they're producing enough hydrogen to meet the market demand?
Yeah. So there your return on investment is more driven by how hard you can drive that electrolyzer, how much hydrogen you can generate. And so I hadn't seen much work at all on this question, surprisingly, that like how there was a few papers, in particular a group out of South Africa that had done some really great work on looking at this limit with a unique electrolyzer geometry. But most people had topped out around an amp per centimeter squared or so. And the reason is most people will study these electrolyzers where they just have two plates kind of opposed in a beaker. So if you try to run this thing really hard, pretty soon your anode or cathode, one or the other, is going to be covered with gas and you won't be able to pass any more electricity through it. So we thought, well, how about you run flow over the electrode and like fluid flow to drive the gas off? And then you can imagine, okay, a metal plate is good, but what if I make the surface area of that metal plate way bigger, you know, and so by splitting it into tiny nanowires. And so you can imagine taking like a piece of steel wool, like that's going to have a lot more surface area than a piece of steel, right? So if it has more surface area, there's more surface area to pass electricity to the hydrogen atoms in the water.
So you're looking at speeding up the electrolysis process. What different material did you use?
We looked at three different length scales of these kind of porous materials made of nickel. In this case, we use like a nickel foam, a nickel microwire mesh, and a nickel nanowire mesh or felt. And we thought the nanowire felt would be the best, but it wasn't. We thought it would be the best because it has the highest surface area, but it also was very tight and trapped the bubbles from water splitting. So it was the microwire mesh that we could flow the bubbles out. And so that ended up being the best electrode. And then after choosing the best electrode, we're like, okay, how high can we drive this? You know, and we're pumping fluid through it and driving a lot of current, and the fluid is actually also helping to cool the electrode. And the highest currents we could get was about 25 amps per centimeter squared. So it's about 50 times greater where alkaline, than kind of the high end for commercial alkaline electrolyzers, and about 25 times greater than what's typically done. And even for these very high power electrolyzers that were developed by this South African group, that was still about like 6 or 7 times higher than that. And it was at that point, it was limited by burning the membrane. So we would be passing so much current through this membrane, it would like literally like melt or burn. So it could potentially go even higher if we were using a more conductive or more thermally stable membrane.
And so it sounds like that's a pretty big kind of game-changing proposition there. If you're able to improve the amount of hydrogen by, is it, I guess, 25 times that you're producing?
Yeah. Something like that, right? Depending on what you're comparing with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it, you know, you can imagine just sort of massive, that having a huge impact. And obviously, you know, you mentioned that you got into science to get rich. So...
I mean, it's not untrue. I mean, it'd be a nice to have. So, but I'm doing okay.
Yeah. I mean, why not? What are the next steps there?
Yeah. So funny you mentioned that. So there actually was an individual who kind of leads a group of investors who reached out last summer. And so we've been kind of iterating on a plan to bring it to market. So that is actually in the works.
So next question, you know, are there any sort of near-term scalable applications of green hydrogen fuel?
Yeah, I think the lowest hanging fruit is those applications where it's currently people using hydrogen from natural gas or coal, right? So ammonia is a huge one. Methanol is another one. And then people are interested in using hydrogen to make steel. People are also looking at electrifying iron production, like just using kind of electrolysis directly, but in molten iron. That has more scalability challenges potentially. So that would be a great application, right? Probably longer term out is looking at, yeah, using ammonia for shipping, powering shipping and powering aviation. Right now, there's just like it's in the conceptual stage. I think there's I don't even know if there's any, you know, a plane. I think there might be a plane powered off a fuel cell, but yeah, it's nothing commercial yet. And of course, there's been like a long drive to make fuel cell vehicles, like back from Bush era, right, in the early 90s. And that has gone nowhere because Mercedes closed its program. I think there was another car company, yeah, like a Swedish car, like car and truck maker that shut down its fuel cell program. So just because of the efficiency issue and the cost issue, you know, they just never scaled up the... There had been an estimate if they could make like a million fuel cell cars a year, you could start to get economies of scale there, but just never got to that point. And then, of course, you need a hydrogen refueling infrastructure, which also doesn't exist, unlike where you can't just plug it in the wall like you can with a battery car. So that ship seems to have sailed. So that's probably not where hydrogen is going to go. So it's more in these hard to decarbonize areas is the greatest potential. Yeah.
Well, Ben, thanks so much for joining us. We really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thanks, James. I appreciate you guys reaching out.
So that was Ben Wiley of Duke University talking to us about his research and hydrogen as an energy carrier. From what I understand about hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, you know, even though they have had a bit of a rough time breaking into the market due to costs and efficiency, lack of infrastructure, there are some pros. Recharging time, for example. Electric cars, on average, can take between 45 minutes to several hours to fully refuel, whereas with hydrogen cars, you can refuel them, you know, within a couple of minutes. So they do have that advantage.
Yeah. And what's even better is you can go longer distances because of how energy dense hydrogen fuel is.
This would make hydrogen particularly attractive, therefore, for, you know, long haul shipping, aviation, like Dr. Wiley was saying. So in fact, the larger the vehicle, the more sense hydrogen might make from a cost and energy use perspective.
And again, the only emissions coming from vehicles powered by hydrogen is water, which is mind blowing. So that is it for this episode of the Climate Now podcast. For more details and visuals on hydrogen fuel and how it's made, check out our hydrogen fuel video on our website. You can check out other interviews, watch all of our videos, and sign up for our newsletter at climatenow.com. And if you want to get in touch, email us at contact@climatenow.com or tweet at us at @WeAreClimateNow. We hope you'll join us for our next conversation. Thank you.